They do have a majority of seats, but there's three of them, and they don't see eye to eye on everything. So it's still up for question whether this government can be formed. And it's up to question how the government will look, because of the 70 pro-independence deputies that were elected yesterday, 8 are either in exile or imprisoned currently.
I want to thank you very much, Sebastian Faber, for joining us, professor of Hispanic Studies at Oberlin College, author of the new book, Memory Battles of the Spanish Civil War, History, Fiction, and Photography. Tune in Monday for our holiday special when we speak with Noam Chomsky for the hour. We'll talk about climate change, nuclear weapons, North Korea, Iran, and the Republican Party. He says the Republican Party in the United States today is the most dangerous organization on earth. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
KBOO Portland.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5 o'clock. Coming up next is your Friday evening news.
Did you know that KBOO's daily evening newscast is produced by a team of volunteers right here in our Portland studios? If you've got some extra time and would like to get free training in radio news production, come on down to the studio and get involved. You can learn interviewing, writing, editing, and production skills, all for free, in a fun and supportive environment. Call KBOO's volunteer coordinator, Ani Haynes, at 503-231-8032 to get involved. That number again is 503-231-8032 to volunteer with KBOO Evening News.
KBOO is in this year's Willamette Week Give Guide. KBOO has inspired and supported communities for nearly 50 years. You were an important part of this work, and your gift to KBOO builds fiercely just, creative, and independent radio. Join your friends and neighbors in supporting KBOO in the Give Guide. It's easy and secure. Help us make our $18,000 goal before December 31st. Go to the giveguide.org website and find KBOO in the Creative Expression section. And as always, thank you for your support of KBOO.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the second largest Medicaid supplier in Oregon is shutting down next month.
Governor Brown has requested an additional $5 million to address homelessness in Oregon.
Commissioner Chloe Udaly has been sued by a local advocate for the homeless.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, December 22nd, 2017, the 337th day of the Trumpocalypse. I'm Linda Olson-Osterlund.
And I'm Ruben Lawrence. Oregon's second largest Medicaid carrier will shut down on January 31st of next year. The announcement was made after Family Care and the Oregon Health Authority failed to come to an agreement on a contract for 2018. The shutdown will affect over 110,000 adults and children in the greater Portland area and result in the layoff of its 322 employees. Family Care and the state have long disagreed over Medicaid reimbursement rates. Family Care CEO Jeff Hetherington claims that the 2018 reimbursement rate would force the company into bankruptcy, and the board of directors voted last week not to sign a new contract with the state. The uncertainty had raised concern by providers and patients, with state officials reporting that there already had been actual denials of care, but Hetherington denied that patients had been turned away. The current contract ends on December 31st, but the state and Family Care agreed to a 30-day extension to give clients time to transfer to another carrier. Clients won't lose their Medicaid coverage, and Medicaid rules will allow them to continue seeing their current providers for at least 90 days. The state said it is working with three other coordinated care organizations to take on Family Care's members: HealthShare of Oregon, Yamhill Community Care, and Willamette Valley Community Health.
On Thursday, Governor Kate Brown announced that she will ask the legislature to approve an additional $5 million in state funding to provide shelter for homeless families. She made the announcement while visiting Human Solutions, a shelter for parents and children at 160th and Stark. If approved, $2.6 million would go to Multnomah County, and the remainder would go to statewide programs run by Oregon Housing and Community Services. The most recent count of homelessness found that over 4,000 of Oregon's homeless population was living in Multnomah County. The overall population in the state is 14,000. Many feel that the number doesn't tell the whole story of family homelessness. According to the Oregon Department of Education, over 23,000 K through 12 students last year fit the definition of homeless. That number equates to approximately 4% of the entire K through 12 population of the state. There is no guarantee that the legislature will approve the governor's request. In January, voters will decide whether to approve a tax on hospitals and health insurers to help fund the Oregon's Medicaid program. If that measure fails, the state faces a $320 million budget shortfall.
Yesterday, Portland City Commissioner Chloe Udaly was sued by Portland homeless advocate Mimi German. German filed the suit in federal court claiming that Udaly violated her First and 14th Amendment rights. German's lawsuit claims that Udaly has mocked her disruption of city council meetings via Facebook posts. The suit alleges that Udaly's posts have prompted rude or threatening responses from others. German has been a vocal advocate for the homeless at numerous council meetings, frequently leading supporters in shouts and heckling that would bring the meetings to a halt. German said that the abusive Facebook posts have given her nightmares and caused her to fear for her personal safety. The lawsuit states that one commenter said that German should be, quote, locked up in a nut house, end quote. Another commenter implied a threat by posting a picture of a vandalized building near German's place of employment. She also claims that posts referencing city business are subject to a public records request. Udaly has refused that request. But Oregon State Archivist Mary Beth Heckert has indicated support for German's request. This is not the first time that Udaly's Facebook tactics have come under fire. A November story in the Oregonian noted that Udaly's posts have, quote, condemned protesters at city council meetings, dismissed some of the public testimony to the council, and disputed the findings in news stories critical of her bureaus, end quote.
In a report that will surprise no one, the real estate website Zillow reported that Portland had one of the largest median rent increases in the country in 2017. Portland rents rose by 4.6% in 2017 to an average of nearly $1,900 a month. Nationwide, the average rent increase was at 2.4%, and the average rent is $1,435. Forecasters are predicting that Portland rents will increase by another 4.7% in 2018. Home prices climbed at an even steeper rate of 5.7%, with the average home in the Portland area costing $370,000. Nationwide, average incomes rose by 2.5% in 2017.
On Tuesday, the Washington State Energy Facility Site Evaluation Council recommended that permits for the Vancouver Energy Oil Terminal be denied. The final decision is now up to Washington Governor Jay Inslee. If built, the terminal would handle over 360,000 barrels of Bakken crude oil per day. The oil would be delivered to the terminal by rail, where it would be transferred to ships and sent to refineries. The council provided the governor with a document containing over 500 pages of facts and legal conclusions supporting their recommendation. Inslee has not spoken about the project, but his administration has been characterized as environmentally oriented. Inslee has 60 days to make a decision, but even if he decides in favor of the terminal, it appears unlikely to move forward at this time. This fall, Vancouver residents elected a second port commissioner who opposes the terminal. That gives the commission the votes it needs to cancel the port's lease.
Charities are concerned that the new Republican tax plan could result in fewer donations. They're concerned that the new rules will reduce the incentive for individuals to give. Under the new tax bill, the standard deduction has been doubled to $12,000 for individuals and $24,000 for couples. The charities are concerned that the rule change will mean that fewer taxpayers itemize their deductions, reducing their incentive to give to charities. In Oregon, hundreds of nonprofits could be affected. A decline in contributing could mean that charitable nonprofits that provide everything from food and shelter to legal aid and job training would have to cut back on services to the very people who need them the most. And according to the Nonprofit Association of Oregon, a cutback on charitable contributions would also have serious economic implications for the state. The association points out that 183,000 Oregonians, equal to 12% of the private workforce, are employed by nonprofits. Association Director Jim White said, quote, "That's larger than manufacturing in Oregon, so if we see job losses in the charitable sector, that actually That's larger than manufacturing in Oregon, so if we see job losses in the charitable sector, that's actually a contradiction to what this bill was supposed to do," end quote.
Nothing has angered fans of the internet more than the FCC's recent 3-2 vote to roll back net neutrality rules. But the fight appears to be far from over. Colin Gibb is a journalist and consultant. He is also the editor of Fierce Wireless, an internet daily that monitors the wireless industry. KBOO's Tom Flynn spoke with Gibb about the continuing fight over net neutrality.
Our guest today is Colin Gibbs. He's the author of an article, Why the Fight for Net Neutrality is Far From Over, published in Fierce Wireless on December 15th. Colin, welcome. We've been thinking here about the FCC 3-2 decision on December 14th, that was the end of the internet as we knew it, that net neutrality was over. How is it that that decision is just the beginning of a discussion?
There are a lot of things going on with net neutrality, despite the fact that the 3-2 vote is likely to kill it temporarily, at least, and maybe for a while. But there are avenues through which that could be overturned, and change in the presidential administration would almost certainly change the makeup of the FCC and bring it back into play.
Well, once companies like Verizon get control of the flow of the pipeline and the elimination of neutrality, wouldn't it be nearly impossible to reverse that?
I don't believe so. First of all, I think carriers like Verizon are going to need to be pretty careful about how they leverage the repeal of net neutrality laws. There are plenty of watchdog groups and other people out there keeping an eye on the carriers and shining light where they see unfair play. So I don't see anybody rushing in to exploit this in any overt way, and I don't think that, you know, if net neutrality was, if the rules were put in play 2 years ago, they could be put in play again.
So a change in administration is one of the factors. What else?
There are a couple other factors through which this might not play out the way some people believe. One way it would be congressional legislation. There has been talk in Congress for years about addressing some of the concerns over net neutrality. Those talks have not gone anywhere, but there are Republicans who have recently tried to get the ball rolling, as it were, for what has normally been a very, very Democrat-supported effort to keep net neutrality rules in place or establish new net neutrality rules.
What about the work of the attorneys general in this area?
Right before the FCC voted 3-2 along party lines to repeal net neutrality rules, almost 20 U.S. attorneys general lobbied the FCC not to repeal them. Of course, that happened anyway, but I believe New York has already filed a suit to against the repeal of those rules. I fully expect to see other states either file their own suits or to join New York's lawsuit. And net neutrality has been something that's gone back and forth in the courts for at least several years now. It's become something of a political and a judicial football.
You mentioned that the FCC decision needs to be reviewed by the OMB and GAO in the federal government. Is that just a formality, or could that really lead to some change?
I don't expect any pushback there. I've not spoken to anybody who believes that that's going to be a problem for them to get, particularly given the political climates in Washington right now. So I'm not sure I'd call it a formality, but I don't expect that to be a problem. The FCC still needs to establish final language and probably vote on final language before it would get approval from those two offices, and then the repeal would come into effect 60 days after that. We're looking at probably second quarter of next year before this thing actually occurs.
Well, anything else I should have asked you about this subject that would be of interest to our listeners?
I don't think so, other than just to reiterate, it's going to be something to be paying attention to for quite a while. And once again, when net neutrality rules were established a few years ago, that was not the end of that fight. So the repeal of them, even the enactment of the repeal of them in a few months, will not be the end of the fight.
Colin, thanks for joining us on KBOO.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
For KBOO News, this has been Tom Flynn.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin at 5:30, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather calls for a cloudy day with high temperature of around 40. East of the Cascades in Hood River, you can also expect a cloudy morning with some afternoon sunshine and temperatures in the mid-30s. On this date in 2010, President Barack Obama signed a bill ending Department of Defense Directive 130.426, often referred to as the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. It was an awkward compromise that was supposed to prohibit military personnel from discriminating against or harassing closeted homosexual or bisexual members of the armed forces, while simultaneously prohibiting those same individuals from publicly disclosing their sexual orientation. Referring to the repeal in 2015, Obama said, quote, "From the boardroom to the locker room, LGBT Americans will face prejudice in their daily lives. That kind of prejudice has no place in our country, and as Americans, we need to let every one of them know that they are not alone." End quote.
In a victory for free speech, the first six defendants to be charged with rioting at Trump's inauguration last January have been acquitted of all charges. The six were among more than 150 who were arrested and charged with property destruction, rioting, and conspiracy. They face the possibility of more than 50 years in prison if found guilty. The six defendants acquitted yesterday included a photojournalist and two street medics. Although none of them committed vandalism that day, federal prosecutors tried to make a case that they should be held responsible for property damage done by others. Civil rights and free speech advocates worried that convictions in this trial could set a chilling precedent that peaceful protesters can be held liable for being in the vicinity of violence or vandalism. The verdict, reached after 2 days of deliberations in a D.C. Superior Court, was a setback for the government ahead of a series of other similar trials in 2018. Police arrested most of the defendants using a tactic known as kettling, in which they encircled a group of people and detained everyone inside.
In a hastily contrived White House ceremony earlier today, Donald Trump signed into law the largest change in U.S. tax policy in a generation. The bill was the first real legislative victory the administration has been able to claim, despite the fact that Republicans control both houses of Congress and the presidency. At the ceremony, Trump said, quote, "It's going to be a tremendous thing for the American people," end quote. But in a moment of rare and probably unintended honesty during the signing ceremony, Trump also said, quote, "Corporations are literally going wild over this," end quote. Despite repeated promises by both Trump and his staff that the tax bill would favor the middle class, nonpartisan estimates are that over 80% of the benefits will go to the top 1% of the population. The corporate tax rate drops from 35% to 21%, and the Congressional Budget Office has estimated that the bill will increase the federal deficit by nearly $1.5 billion.
Despite Donald Trump's repeated claims that the Affordable Care Act is dead, Nearly 9 million Americans signed up during this year's Obamacare enrollment period that ended last Friday. This is 96% of last year's 9.2 million total. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services said more than 8.8 million people have signed up in the 39 states served by the federal healthcare.gov website. The strong enrollment came despite Trump's frequent declarations that Obamacare was, quote, imploding, as well as the concerted effort by the White House to accelerate its collapse. This year, the Trump administration cut enrollment season in half, slashed the ad budget, terminated major payments to insurers, and scaled back grants for consumer counselors. The final healthcare.gov numbers will probably be higher because late signups in the Midwest and West have not yet been counted. And the nationwide total won't be known for some time because some states run their own health insurance markets and may continue signing up users through January. Many of the state exchanges reported that signups were running well ahead of last year, and the national enrollment could end up near last year's final number of 12.2 million. Among the healthcare.gov states, Florida led in enrollments with 1.7 million people so far, with Texas next with 1.1 million. Signups for those states could rise since a deadline extension is available for people in hurricane-affected areas.
Congress approved a stopgap spending bill on Thursday to avert government shutdown one day before the deadline. Senators approved the measure 66-32 following a 231-188 vote in the House. The bill keeps government and agencies running and funds the popular Children's Health Insurance Program through March. The bill only funds the federal government until January 19th, though, and many are expecting major fights over spending, immigration, health care, and the military budget early in the new year. When the stopgap bill as a continuing resolution, or CR, passed, members of Congress applauded and prepared to head home for the Christmas break. But not everyone felt good about what they'd accomplished. Florida Republican Representative Thomas J. Rooney said, quote, that we're clapping at a three-week CR just basically shows we can't do appropriations. We can't take care of our constituents back home. For some reason, that justifies applause. I don't get it. I don't get this place. End quote. No doubt most Americans would agree with him.
In this episode of the Civil Liberties Minute, Bill Newman explains why the White House attack on Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller is so dangerous to democracy.
The White House's attack on Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller matters. A lot. Here's why. I'm Bill Newman, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute. The White House, Donald Trump's allies, Fox News, and the alt-right media are attacking Robert Mueller, the FBI, and the Department of Justice, a mission, it appears, to stop Mueller's investigation in its tracks and or to protect President Trump should Mueller's investigation turn out badly for the president. Mueller is investigating Russia's interference with America's election and the connections between the Trump administration, the transition team, and the campaign, and the Russian government. This is very serious business. Mueller's investigation is the embodiment of the rule of law and the premise that no person in America, no matter how powerful, is above the law. The claim that Robert Mueller is some sort of Democratic Party patsy is, by any objective analysis, ludicrous. He's a Republican. George W. Bush named him the FBI director, and he's conducting an investigation that appears to be above reproach. Those orchestrating the campaign to discredit Mueller are not the only ones to blame. Other elected officials, through their silence and acquiescence, are complicit. So we now must heed the adage that nothing strengthens authority so much as silence. Hopefully, not ours. The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the ACLU because freedom can't protect itself.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A Lakota mother and her daughter started their Christmas holiday early this year by purchasing the home they've leased for 6 years. As Jim Kent reports, the Pine Ridge Reservation's Eagle Nest Housing Development was created with the goal of providing a stepping stone for tribal members from renting to home ownership.
Cynthia Plentybull is the first tribal member to purchase a home at the Eagle Nest Housing Development. Although it was dedicated in 1999, Oglala Sioux tribal members have had issues qualifying for home ownership in the 30-unit low-income rental housing facility. Angela Conan is spokesperson for Lakota Funds, the community development financial institution that helped Plentybull purchase her home. She says part of the problem is credit scores.
And so people don't believe that they could become homeowners, that it's possible. We tell them that we're not just going to approve or deny you if you apply for this home loan. If you have issues like that, like your credit, or you can't make it to the home buyer education class, we'll make every effort to help you.
Now that Cynthia Plentybull has been able to purchase her house, Conan hopes other tenants at the Eagle Nest development will be inspired and convinced that they, too, can own their homes. Plentybull brought her 12-year-old along to the financial literacy classes Lakota Funds required her to attend so she could gain an early understanding of financial responsibility.
I'm looking for the future for her to have a starter home. But if she wants to move off the res or do whatever her plans are, whatever she wants to do, she went through the process with me so she'd understand what she needs to do.
Cynthia and Tia Plentybull will be celebrating Christmas with visiting family in their newly purchased home and say they can't think of a better gift for anyone to give themselves. For National Native News, I'm Jim Kent.
The Federal Communications Commission gave the green light to a South Dakota tribe to build a radio station. When it's on air, it will serve a large part of an area with few broadcasting options. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Ellenbolt reports.
The Cheyenne River Sioux tribe heard of its construction permit approval this month. The station is already assigned call letters KIPI. It will operate at 93.5 on the FM dial. KIPI will have Eagle Butte as its city of license and will employ 100,000 watts of power, the upper limit of an FM signal in the U.S. From its tower of more than 600 feet, the station will serve listeners across the Cheyenne River Reservation in north-central South Dakota. According to the FCC, KIPI's signal will reach from southern North Dakota to towns along Interstate 90. Tribal leaders hope to have construction done and the station on air next spring. They're planning a music and cultural programming format with educational programming featured on a separate high-definition radio channel. For National Native News, I'm Gary Ellenbold.
The state of Maryland recognized the Occohonic tribe with Indian status this week. The Maryland Indian Affairs Commission recommended state status after the review of documentation, including research of the tribe. The tribe is located on the Eastern Shore. Tribal members met with state officials this week to receive the executive order granting the state Indian status. According to the executive order, there are about 58,000 people with American Indian heritage living in Maryland. Navajo police say people are safe and a suspect is in custody after gunshots were fired Thursday near an elementary school in Shiprock, New Mexico. Police say a male suspect was apprehended with a handgun in his possession. The school was put on lockdown as police investigated the incident. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Tom Flynn and Ray Bodwell. The producer is Ray Bodwell. Our engineer is Jenna Yokoyama, and the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund.
And I'm Reuben Lawrence. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, More Talk Radio presents On the Ground Radio with a look at the battle over the Potomac pipeline, DACA, the GOP tax scam, medical marijuana, and Jerusalem. At 9, the Old Mole Variety Hour explores the revival of labor unions, plus the movie moles revisit the 1983 Christmas classic, Trading Places. At 10 on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein talks with author and sailor Marcus Erickson about his book, Junkraft, An Ocean Voyage and a Rising Tide of Activism to Fight Plastic Pollution. At 11 on Making Contact, an inside look at what it's like to parent from prison. And at 11:30 on Voices for the Animals, Dab Stedman talks to the Vital Ground Land Trust about their efforts to protect and restore grizzly bears. KABU keeps you informed and you can get involved. Go to kabu.fm and click on Donate to become a member. Thanks for listening and have a good evening. Good night, Linda.
Good night, Ruben. Good night, Jenna.
Good night, everybody.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the Supreme Court has okayed full implementation of Donald Trump's Muslim travel ban, despite the fact that its constitutionality is still being challenged in lower courts, despite the fact that even the Department of Homeland Security reports show no relationship between the targeted countries and national security threats, and despite the fact that Trump gives the lie to the White House assertion that the ban isn't anti-Muslim every time he opens his mouth. With so many facts being